KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman, and this is Weekday. A few weeks ago, we talked with Temple Grandin about what new brain research can tell us about autism. Some of that research is being done at the University of Washington. We're going to talk with Patricia Kuhl later this hour. And Thursday's the day we travel back to the golden age of radio. Katie Sewell and Steve Scherr will have another installment in our ongoing radio retrospective. Kenya's Truth, Justice, and Reconciliation Commission last week issued a long-awaited report that names the country's president and his deputy among those who bear responsibility for post-election violence in Kenya in 2007 and 2008. More than 1,000 people died in the aftermath of that election. Seattle University law professor Ronald Sly was one of three international members of the commission, and he joins us now by phone. Hello.
Hi, Marcy.
When was the Truth, Justice, and Reconciliation Commission actually formed?
It was set up in August of 2009, and as you said in your introduction, the event that precipitated its creation was the violence related to the election in 2007. But our mandate actually was much broader in that we were to look at human rights violations broadly defined from independence, which was 1963, until the end of that post-election violence, so the end of February 2008.
Who put the commission together and gave you that task?
It was a government commission, so the government of Kenya, as part of the mediated peace agreement after the post-election violence in 2007 that was mediated by, among others, the former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, the government agreed to set up a truth commission. And there were originally nine commissioners, six Kenyans and three internationals, and the six Kenyans were chosen through a process involving civil society and parliament in Kenya. The three internationals, we were chosen by a panel that consisted of Kofi Annan and two other prominent African leaders.
It's interesting that you would be tasked with going back to the independence of Kenya because, in fact, what it seems like is that the government was telling you to investigate it, and in fact, you found, or the commission found, that a lot of the problems did relate to the Kenyatta family.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think the idea behind the commission was to really try and understand what the sort of the underlying reasons were for the violence that had erupted somewhat unexpectedly for most people during the 2007 election. So there was a commission that was set up to look specifically at that violence. Mm-hmm. That commission lasted less than a year, and it's that commission that actually triggered eventually the International Criminal Court to get involved in Kenya. The idea behind our commission was really to look at broader structural issues. And we looked at three different administrations, the first Kenyatta administration, Daniel Arap Moi's administration, and Mwai Kibaki, who was the most recent predecessor administration, and found gross violations of human rights committed under all three administrations.
Is there a root structural cause?
You know, I think a major issue in Kenya is land. The British, when they had colonized Kenya, pretty much stole most of the productive land for themselves. And then when they handed over the country to the first Kenyatta government during independence, much of that productive land was then grabbed by President Kenyatta and some of his close allies. And that's been a never-ending struggle. And related to that is the issue of ethnicity. And what the British also did was to both sort of solidify and also even create new notions of ethnicity within within Kenya, which is a phenomenon that we've seen in many post-colonial societies, Rwanda being one that people are probably more familiar with in terms of the Belgian influence there, and then associate different ethnic groups with different plots of lands, which was something that for some groups was somewhat true, but wasn't nearly as solidified as a social reality as it was before the British got involved. So you have this struggle that continues to this day where people identify certain geographical areas with certain ethnic groups, and when other tensions arise, then you have this sort of insider-outsider dynamic that leads to, in many cases, some pretty horrific violence.
We're talking with Seattle University Law Professor Ronald Sly, and as I listen to you describe this, there are many countries around the world where we see that, well, nation building is always difficult, but when there's a diversity of groups within who have land that has culturally been their own, this is problematic. Is it more problematic in Kenya because of what the British did?
I can compare it to other places so well. I know Kenya much better than I know many other countries at the moment. But it certainly is a very serious problem there, and it's something that they're still grappling with. And it's such a sensitive issue that, in fact, at the end of our process just a few weeks ago, we were placed under enormous pressure by the president's office to change certain things in the land chapter because of the sensitive nature of land in the country.
I understand that you left the commission. Was it at that time?
No, I didn't leave. About 2 years ago, I think it was, I announced that I was going to resign, which had nothing to do with land. This had to do with our chairman, who was and is implicated in three of the areas that we were to investigate. And we had sort of a long story, but we had petitioned for a tribunal to be set up to evaluate him, which he had agreed to have done, but then when it was set up, he then sued it and got it stopped, and then came back into the commission. So during all of that, at one point, I announced that I was going to resign, but then the tribunal was set up actually to evaluate him, so then I agreed to stay. And in fact, he was away from us for about 14 months, which is when we got the bulk of our work done.
I understand that you were also involved in South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Yeah, I was a consultant to the research department in at the South African Commission.
Is that what led to your involvement in the Kenyan Commission?
I think it probably contributed to it. I had had the experience in South Africa. My area of expertise is international criminal law and international human rights law, and I've written in the area a lot. So I think when they were starting to look for international commissioners, my name came up in part because of those experiences.
Well, the commission issued its findings last week. What happens to them now?
So we issued findings and recommendations, and part of what we have done, which is what we're empowered to under the act that created us, is to recommend an implementation mechanism, which is an independent body that will both monitor implementation of our recommendations, most of which, although not all, but most of which have to do with the government and the government doing certain things, whether it's reforming laws or providing reparations or investigating further particular individuals. And the hope is that, and in our recommendations, we give timelines. We say that within 3 months, such and such should happen. Within 6 months, such and such should happen. So the hope is that that those recommendations will, in fact, be implemented. The government at the moment has said that they will look seriously at it and have every intention of implementing. But, of course, it's easy to say that, and we'll see as time goes on whether they live up to that promise or not.
So the commission has no enforcement power?
No. Well, I mean, the commission is pretty much winding down now. So the commission, in a few months, we will no longer legally exist. The implementation mechanism will continue to exist. And, you know, it doesn't have its own police force or anything of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
But there are requirements that, for example, the Minister of Justice or his equivalent is to report to Parliament. I think it's every 6 months. To report progress on our recommendations. And so there's some built-in political levers for civil society and victims and others to try and hold the government accountable for the recommendations that we've made.
Will there be any kind of outside monitoring?
There's no formal outside monitoring, although I suspect that many both domestic and international human rights organizations will monitor independently our recommendations and the government's implementation of them. But there's nothing that we've set up or that is formally set up at a governmental level to do that.
In listening to you speak a few minutes earlier about the problems of land and the cultural claims, traditional cultural claims on land and who appropriated land from whom, it sounds that this is a huge issue that one report can maybe take a bite out of, but we're going back decades.
Yeah. No, it's, you know, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, it's a very tricky situation, even in the best of circumstances. And there have been commissions in the past in Kenya that have looked at land, and they've all had their both strengths and weaknesses. There's a new National Land Commission that has been set up under the new constitution Kenya passed as part of the overall reforms after the 2007 election violence, created a new constitution, which was passed in 2010. So there's a new National Land Commission, which is to look at, among other things, the historical issues related to land. And, you know, our mandate was to look at assassinations, at massacres, at torture, rape, violations of socioeconomic rights, so housing, water, land, economic marginalization, corruption, and a bunch of other things. So it was incredibly broad. And there was no way that we could do justice to any one of those. So what we did is we tried to add value given both past and current and projected future initiatives. And so with respect to land, we looked a bit at land. It certainly came up a lot in our interviews with people all over the country. And based in part upon what they were telling us and their concerns and even their proposed remedies, we've then made a recommendation that the new National Land Commission take a lot of the information that we've collected and come up with a plan to start to address the issue of land.
Wow. It's amazing work that you did. Thank you so much for sharing part of it with us today.
No, thank you for having me.
Seattle University Professor Ronald Sly was one of three international members of Kenya's Truth, Justice, and Reconciliation Commission. Last week, it issued a long-awaited report about the aftermath of post-election violence in Kenya in 2007, 2008, and longer back in time at problems of injustice and land and human rights abuses in that country. This is Weekday.
Ten 19, brain science and predicting future abilities in autistic children in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Friends of Youth, providing services in 2012 to more than 5,000 East King County youth, including foster care, emergency shelter, counseling, and housing at 20 locations. Learn more at friendsofyouth.org, helping kids since 1951.
It's cloudy and breezy and 54 degrees in Seattle. We're expecting showers today with a high of 61, then a slim chance of showers overnight, dropping down to 49, and tomorrow Friday it looks like clouds in the morning, mostly sunny later in the day with a high of 66. It's 10:20. I'm Bernard Ouellette. A look at the rules of writing radio drama in 20 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. A new study of very young children diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder has linked their response to language to future skill development. The study was headed up by Dr. Patricia Kuhl, who co-directs the University of Washington's Institute for Learning and Brain Sciences' iLabs for short. And I'm delighted to have Dr. Kuhl in the studio with me today.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming in.
It's wonderful to be here.
Let's start off with who you studied exactly.
Okay. So in this study, this is a very large study where we're bringing in children through a clinical diagnosis that gives them a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder at the age of 2.
Wow.
And this is a massive study in which we plan ahead of time to study them at the age of 2, then again at the age of 4, and then again at the age of 6. And my role in the study is to do the initial measures at age 2 of language. And so we had the exciting opportunity to decide what do we want to measure. And we landed on work that we'd been doing with typically developing children on a brain signature that has to do with the recognition of words that you know.
A brain signature means what part of your brain activates.
It's not only what part, but it's what it looks like. What is that brain signature? We call it a signature because it's a pattern of brain waves that happens at a particular point in time and takes a particular shape and is in a particular location.
And maybe you want to explain how you're able to do that.
Right. Well, in this study, we're using event-related potentials. And what that means is that you are the children, the babies can be measured even, are wearing a nylon cap and it has sensors in it. And the sensors just sitting on the scalp are able to pick up the brain waves that sort of leak from the scalp as the brain does its work. And the particular stimulus that you play, like a word or a syllable that is contained in the language, has a very characteristic brainwave response that's picked up by these sensors.
Now, that is based on work you've been doing work for many years on language development.
Yes.
And so I assume that's why you thought, well, okay, well,
we'll do words. Yeah.
So did you then bring in a pool of kids and start measuring?
Or? So the two-year-olds enter the study through a process of the clinical evaluation. Mm-hmm. And then we were, and there's a selected control group because you always want to compare the responses that you're measuring against typical controls. And so at the age of 2, we brought both groups into the laboratory, and the task is quite simple. We talk to parents ahead of time about what words they're child knows. Mm-hmm. We take very common words, milk, cup, that kind of thing. And we compare known words and ask mothers, does your child know this word? Maybe sometimes they're producing the word, but do they know this word? And then we pick a group of unknown words that are words of English, simple single syllable words, but ones that a two-year-old is not going to know yet, like mast, okay. You know, the words at tube that they're not likely to know. And so the baby child, this is a two-year-old, sitting on a mom's lap and has something to distract them, and an assistant is sort of manipulating some quiet toys while the baby, this child, is listening to the words, and both known words and unknown words, and we're looking for this signature response to known words.
And what you found was really fascinating because in the control group, the typically developing children, the brain responds in one place, but in depending on how severe the autistic, where they are on the spectrum, it was different parts of the brain that responded?
Okay, so here's what happens. On the left temporal parietal lobe, so right above your ear on the left side, typically developing children are showing this very different waveform when they hear a known word as opposed to an unknown word. And we looked at the children with autism, and when you look at them as a group, it's just not there. It's simply absent. But when you do a more careful look at the children with autism and divide them into two groups based on the severity of their social symptoms, ones that are really severely socially impaired, as opposed to ones that are not so socially impaired, because we know that children on the spectrum are widely varying, what we saw in the children who are less socially impaired is a more typical response on the left, in that left location. And again, in the children with more severe symptoms, not seeing that response. So we took this measure, once we had identified it does exist in some children with autism, at the electrode location P3 on the left.
Okay, I'm sure somebody knows what that means.
Some do. It's on the left, above your left ear.
Okay.
So we use that to predict the future for all the children with autism. So meaning we take that measure, and we say, how strongly did the brain at the age of two respond to known words? And we use that to try to predict the outcomes of measures that we took at age four and age six. And the measures we took at four and six were very large batteries of standardized tests that were either in the linguistic domain, in the cognitive domain, or in what we call adaptive behavior domain. And these are standardized against large numbers of children.
Okay.
The outcome was really surprising, that this predictor at age two predicted better than anything else we know at the age of four and six, got better over time. So it's even a stronger predictor at age six than at age four, and not only predicted language abilities in these children, but their cognitive abilities and their adaptive behaviors.
Okay, so now my brain, whatever part of my brain, just exploded, and I thought, well, what does that tell us about typically developing brain and a brain of maybe a child who's pretty far on the has more difficulties with their social interactions? They're the kids who didn't have any kind of response in that left part of their brain.
Right. So we have a theory. It's called the social gating hypothesis. We think that skills that are delivered through cultural experience, through a social experience in a particular a country and society, is this kind of social gate that as a child, you have to be both interested in the social other, and that enables you to provide yourself with more information by watching the behaviors of that person, by looking at what they look at as they name things, by trying to read their intentions, by looking at their actions and everything about what they do. It's like tapping the inside of that person's social mind. And secondly, we think there's a motivational component that even beyond the information you gain, that just being in the mere presence of another human being changes your motivational level. Mm. We like to think of the brain being turned on in a new way in the presence of another person. And so this social gate is what we think sort of modulates the more computational, calculating brain that also works to acquire words and sounds and grammar of the language. So this computational component we've been studying and others have been studying for since the 1990s, mm-hmm. that we can predict what you might learn from listening to Japanese as opposed to English,
right,
using probabilistic statistics to say, what is it that's contained? What are the syllables and how are they arranged? But this new idea adds something to that, to say, yes, there is a computational component. You have to be able to learn statistically, so to speak, mm-hmm. but that the gate has to be there. This social gate is the way to get into that analysis.
We're talking with Dr. Patricia Kuhl, who's the co-director of the Institute for Learning and Brain Sciences at the University of Washington. And you mentioned you have been studying for years this sort of the way that, in the most simplistic terms that I can understand it, the way that we form the pathways in our brains to learn many things. And so are you saying that this might show us, in addition to this social gating, how if you have this particular disorder, a brain might develop differently?
Yes. I think that children with autism see the world through a different lens. And if we understood the lens, we might be able to arrange the world in interventions that would allow them to be interested in that information. So we all know there's a critical period with regard to language. So there's a window of opportunity when the brain is ready for that information. And if our social gating hypothesis is true, that gate has to be open. If it's not open, then those computational mechanisms don't do their job. What we're trying to imagine as a future possibility is that we believe our measure at the age of two is a measure of that enormous complexity, that a child mm-hmm. at two who recognizes a known word using this left hemisphere area is showing the combination of computational and social skills, which take place in two different parts of the brain and have to be united. So if we can arrange a situation in future interventions that is sufficiently entertaining, interesting, and grabbing to a child with autism, you could use that lens, get in there with the information, and change the course of history for that child and that child's family.
Because you'll help form that pathway.
You'll make the pathway resemble the kind of information that that child is interested in. So it's that the brain is behaving differently, looking through, seeing the world through a different lens than the child who's typically developing. But it's not as though that lens doesn't function. And let me give you another example. In an earlier study, we'd given toddlers with autism and typically developing children a choice of listening to either motherese or a sine wave analog.
So motherese would be, oh, honey.
Hello. How are you?
Right.
Let's see your big blue eyes.
Right.
Something like that.
Yeah.
better with a two-monther in your hand. Okay. So we gave them the choice of listening to snippets of that, 8 seconds from different mothers, not their own, against the sine wave analog. So that's a pure tone analog that takes all the important components and on their amplitudes and timing presents a signal that sounds like a computer warble, blah, 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 something like that. And typically developing kids will listen to it once in a while, but they don't prefer it. Whereas children with autism tended to prefer the non-speech analog, you know, this pure tone analog. And the more they prefer it, the more severe their autistic symptoms. Now, at least what that shows is that there is a preference for a complex auditory signal if you can capture something about what that signal means about their brain's lens on the world, on the auditory world, you might be able to capitalize on it.
You have your entree into all of this, as I mentioned earlier, was the idea of where we how we acquire language and sort of what that opens up for us. At what point did you turn your focus to autistic brains?
Well, I think that the discovery we made in 2003 was a turning point for my laboratory, and that was one in which we exposed typically developing nine-monthers to a foreign language for the first time, and we were on the computational hypothesis saying, well, what happens if a baby has to statistically compute information from a brand new language for the first time at 9 months? Can they do it? And so we arranged this very natural situation. Kids are playing on the floor with my foreign-speaking graduate students and postdocs, and they come in 12 times over a month's time. What we discover is they learn phenomenally live, but when you do the same material, same dosage over a television set, beautiful DVDs, or audio only, and they watch a teddy bear on the screen, no learning whatsoever occurs, even though they stare at the screen a lot. So we developed this social gating hypothesis based on that. It then clicked that the study of autism, which is this twin deficit in social and language, also shows this linkage between the two, and it made very, very good sense.
And also underlying that, it sounds like, is that that our brains at two, and possibly even now, at least I hope it's the case, are plastic, that there is the possibility of, if something is not quite typically connected, that we can form another connection that would allow us to do the task,
right?
Because there's so many things in there.
Exactly. So we learn beautifully all our lives, but we learn differently. And so there are some domains in which there are clear limitations in your ability to learn at different ages. So language is one of those in which biologists describe the critical period phenomenon. It applies quite soundly. So you bring your three-year-old to Paris, as we did when our three-year-old was three, and she was absorbing the vocabulary and the sentence structure, and we're dumbfounded by her ability to just grab it up, just suck it up, just sponge it up, and certainly what was going on in her brain was not going on in ours, and that's been repeated over and over again that between 0 and 7, your capacity to acquire new languages is totally different than it is after that. It doesn't say you can't acquire it, but you'll acquire it with different brain mechanisms and with different facility.
Oh, that's sad news for me and my age.
Yes, me too.
The last time you and I spoke, you were in Washington, D.C. It was just as the president's proposed brain mapping initiative was hitting the news, and then everything got silent. So I was wondering if you could give us a brief update about...
Oh, there's a lot of activity worrying in the background. So the first 100 million that the president has dedicated to this brain initiative is likely to go at the other end of the spectrum. So if you think about neuroscience, there's two ends of the spectrum. One is to visualize and examine individual neurons and many of them at once. You want to see them in action. You want to turn them on at will, that kind of thing. And that's typically done in animals and in careful studies at that micro level. We're at the macro level, looking at whole brains operating at once using brain imaging technology. We want to see how the social brain and the language brain does its work together, how memory and language and judgment and all of the really important things that humans only do, how does that work? How do systems interact? So this is called systems neuroscience, and the other side is molecular. The first money, it will eventually try to link these two. So the grand scheme is to take these and bring them closer together. Mm-hmm. They tend to be different scientists with different training, and not much, you know, goes bidirectionally. But we've started now to do a lot of work to unify the very exciting stuff happening in molecular neuroscience and then in systems. So I think that a good deal of this initial money will go to the development of new technologies that don't exist right now to see many more individual neurons working, you know, firing.
Well, as you mentioned, new technology, iLabs had a grand celebration when you brought in what was totally cutting-edge technology, which was what you used to measure these two-year-olds' patterns. It's a kind of a helmet with sensors that lets you see things. So we're probably at version 4.0 at this point.
So we, in this study that we've published so far, is using a prior technology, event-related potentials, where the little cap is on the head with the sensors. The new technology looks like a hairdryer from Mars, but it's beautifully $2.5 million machine, completely safe, completely non-invasive, completely noiseless. And the baby just sits there. And a person at any age can sit there and can be entertained with toys or do something if we want to test cognitive problem solving, while this device measures directly the current flow and the magnetic fields that it changes. So now, you know, publications are always running 2 years behind. At the moment, we're doing this paradigm. One of our postdocs is doing this, using this paradigm with MEG technology. And this allows you to see deep sources in the brain and what's being activated as differently for known and unknown words. And that will give us the potential to see more deeply what's different about children with autism and typically developing children. And we're going down to 12 to 14 months. So we want to go earlier because the brain is so plastic during this period, and language has this critical window of opportunity. So all of this has to work in concert. We want to diagnose earlier, show the predictive biomarker, be able to say ahead of time, ahead of the diagnosis, this child is greatly at risk, and that opens up brand new doors.
Oh, it's just fascinating. So at some point, the folks at the Allen Brain Institute are on the very micro level.
Yes.
And you at the systems level are going to meet, and fireworks are going to explode over Lake Union, I'm sure.
They are already.
Patricia Kuhl co-directs the University of Washington's Institute for Learning and Brain Sciences. Her newest study, for which she's the lead researcher, is a study of, as she mentioned, brain markers for autism and language and what it tells us about children who are diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder and kids who don't, and maybe can intervene earlier to help those kids develop language. Thanks so much for sharing that with
us. Thanks for having me.
This is KUOW.
What goes into writing radio drama? We'll find out in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Cafe Nordo's Smoked, a spaghetti western staged in Pioneer Square, serving 5 craft cocktails, 4 courses of seasonal food, and Morricone-inspired music through June 23rd. More information at cafenordo.com.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad on the next Radio Lab.
Well, it's certain.
Are you sure?
I don't know.
We've got stories from that surprisingly razor-thin line between certainty and doubt.
No doubt here, you're definitely tuning in for that tomorrow night at 7 on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
KUOW and Fremont Abbey Arts Center present Portland songwriter Kelly Schaefer playing music from her new album and Tacoma Band Apartment Lights, Friday, May 31st at 8 p.m. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
55 degrees in Seattle. There are clouds in the sky, but there's also a stray sunbeam here and there. Forecast says showers are likely today with a high of 61. It's 10:41. I'm Bernard Wallet. Two former allies of late Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic have been acquitted of war crimes by a UN court. More about that in our top-of-the-hour newscast, which is 20 minutes away.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is Jack Benny talking.
Jordan, Rocky Jordan.
Have you ever danced with a murderer?
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
King County.
During the golden age of radio, radio drama was a brand new thing, and people didn't really know how to write for the airwaves in the beginning. I'm Steve Scherr. This is Weekday. Isn't that right, Katie Sewell?
Yeah, that is right.
What was going on? Why were they confused? We had dramas.
Yeah, and in the early days, they just tried to take the dramas we had and stick them on the radio. They were traumatizing stage plays, and they were performing movie scripts on the radio, and, you know, it didn't take long to realize that that just isn't working. Writing plays for the radio was a skill that people needed to figure out, and then once they started getting some notions, they needed to learn how to do it and continue to adapt it as the years went by. And there were a lot of classes that people could take, and there were manuals to guide aspiring radio writers. Today, I thought we would take a look back on some of the big writing rules that most radio shows are built on.
I like thinking about these manuals, these big, heavy, typewritten manuals.
Radio.
How to write for radio. That's very interesting.
Okay, so number one rule, that dramas should be centered on the relationship between people and not purely on plot. Relationships are what give the script color and personality. Now, Carlton E. Morris, who was one of radio's most prolific script writers, wrote all of his script with this notion in mind. He thought that this was the most important rule. And
because radio's all about people, personality, the connection between people.
Yeah, and particularly when you look at the kind of things he wrote, like, for instance, his adventure series, I Love a Mystery. It's focused on friends and people with deep relationships, and that show followed three friends, Jack, Doc, and Reggie.
Yes, sir, Jack. A bunch of doggone heroes. Every doggone one of us.
Oh, look here, Doc.
Yeah, I know how you feel, Reggie. I wouldn't believe it myself. Only here it is, spread over the front pages of every newspaper in the country.
You believe everything you read?
Of course I do. A newspaper wouldn't dare print anything that wasn't true. Looky at this picture of me. Doc Long, the modern Tarzan, who slew a mountain lion with his bare hands.
All right, Tarzan, fold up the newspapers.
What do you mean, fold up the newspapers?
Stop reading that stuff before you begin to believe it. You can keep patting yourself on the back, and you're going to break your arm, and we're going to have to feed you again.
You know, I've never listened to I Love a Mystery.
Oh, you should listen to it. It really, it's still really a great show. If you really check it out.
And because of these guys' relationship.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah, they're really quite great. Okay, rule number two, moving on. This one comes from a booklet in 1932 titled Radio Playwriting by a woman named Jane Sloan. She says, writing a radio play, it must be simple. That means you can't have too many characters, you can't have too many locations. You know, you've heard a lot of scripts that veer away from this.
Yeah.
Particularly in the adventure shows, sometimes they're in way too many locations. But I couldn't find a great audio example of this. So one I could think of was from a movie, the movie Goonies.
Goonies?
There are seven kids in that movie. That's a lot of characters. And they love to talk at once.
Wow! It's a giant piggy bank! It's an
Now, if you can imagine that as a radio play, and you're trying to figure out who all these characters are,
it doesn't work on radio.
Wouldn't work. Okay, the fact that the radio drama unfolds in a listener's imagination is the strength, right, of the medium. It's also the challenge, which, right, of course, brings us to rule number three. This one comes from an essay called What Constitutes a Good Radio Mystery by Charles H. Gabriel Jr. His rule, the audience wants the story dramatized, not read to them. Now, this means that you must somehow weave an explanation narrative into the action.
Yeah, well, we hear that all the time.
Right. But how?
You're in Istanbul now, huh, Rocky? That kind of thing.
Exactly. Well, there are a lot of different approaches, and because I thought it would be fun, we're going to break them down. So the first is the conventional narration approach. A third-person narrator is telling us what's going on, but they're not actually a character in the story. Some radio writers, of course, thought that this technique wasn't artistic at all. It was just too easy for them, and so they would never use it. But it did really work well on the adventure shows. Shows like Challenge of the Yukon, featuring the adventures of Sergeant Preston.
Late that night, as Mary cleaned the supper dishes from the table, Tom reached for his pipe. Supper had been a quiet meal. The strong feeling Tom expressed against Bert Malloy separated them as completely as a wall.
Tom.
Huh?
I want to talk to you. Why don't you like Bert?
You see a mountain lion coming up to your door. You don't open it up to let him in, do you? I feel the same way about that no-good low-down gambler.
I'm going to marry Bert. He's changed.
I can't believe it.
You know what's funny about Sergeant Preston is that it is the only one using that technique that I thought did work. Maybe it was that guy's voice, or maybe it was the writing. But I thought that worked, because usually, as you say, in radio, in movies too, the narration...
Too separate.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe because they worked the sound effects into him talking also. I don't remember hearing that very much in radio.
That's a good point.
Moving on. Another narrative technique was to use a first-person narrative. This is a technique that Orson Welles took credit for creating in the late 1930s. In fact, the original title you might remember for his Mercury Theater show was First Person Singular.
I did not remember that, Katie. I don't believe you did either, did you?
I did.
Wow.
Here's an example of him doing a first-person narration playing Jim Hawkins in a dramatization of Treasure Island.
Squire Trelawney, Dr. Livesey, and the rest of the gentlemen having asked me to write down the whole particulars about Treasure Island from the beginning to the end, keeping nothing back, I take up my pen in the year of grace 1783 and go back to that time 19 years ago when the brown old seaman with a saber cut first took up his lodging under our roof. I was 14. But I remember him as if it were yesterday.
I don't know why he doesn't get credit for it. He doesn't get to claim that.
He's claiming credit, and he's dead, so there's nothing you can do. He claimed it to the grave. But I thought, let's listen to a more vivid example, perhaps a more familiar example of this technique.
It was Wednesday, June 4th. It was warm in Los Angeles. We were working the night watch out of robbery detail. My partner's Ben Romero. The boss is Ed Backstrand, chief of detectives. My name's Friday. I was on my way back from communications, and it was 11:13 p.m. when I got to room 27A. Robbery detail.
There you go, Jack Webb. See, I say he gets some credit.
Well, he did it well.
He did do it
well. That's for sure. Well, and then there was the U technique. It was pioneered on a wartime series that was called The Man Behind the Gun. And here's an example from an episode titled Something for the Girls.
You open the flap of your tent and look up at the sky. But the fading day is clear and blue, the way it is in Italian travel posters. Even so, you turn the palm of your hand up, feeling for rain. The soldier who's digging the drain around your tent grins at you.
It ain't gonna rain, Lieutenant. That's enemy artillery you're hearing up at Murano Pass. They sound off almost every day at sunset.
Artillery? Up there?
Yes, ma'am. You'll get used to it after a while.
Enemy artillery. You look toward Murano Pass, toward the road that leads to Rome. For a moment, you feel the immensity of the job you've taken on. You, an army nurse, an officer in the medical corps. You've got a big assignment, sister. A big assignment.
You.
Yeah,
you're
the character.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and the audience liked that technique.
Is that right?
Yeah, so you start to see it more and more because the you put them in the action, and it got a really nice response.
You know, it's funny, we don't usually do that these days, but Colbert does it. I heard Colbert interviewing Iggy Pop, and I've heard this done before. I think Bill Radke has done it a few times too, where he's, you know, you the introduction, you know, like instead of saying Iggy Pop is a musician and the pro proto-punk rocker. He said, Iggy Pop, you were Pop. You were a musician. You were the proto-punk rocker.
Mm.
And it was an interesting, in some ways still awkward, but it was an interesting approach. And it sort of has its antecedents in this, doesn't it?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. So those are the narrative techniques that worked. And that brings us to rule number four. Avoid using the look-see system of narration. Here is an example.
Kelly's really getting this lot filled in. Looks like the Dolans are starting out for a drive.
Yeah. Look-see.
The look-see system, it's one where a character describes everything that they're seeing to another character. If you start using it too much in a script, you know, the listeners start to wonder, what's wrong with the second character? Why can they not make any observations on their own? Are they a toddler? As one of the, you know, oh, here comes a bus, you know, that kind of thing. Now, radio shows still did use that technique. You know, oh, a blue car is pulling up. Is that yours? You know, something like that. But you're not supposed to use it entirely.
Sparingly, huh?
Yes. Ultimately, to write a good radio script, you want to set the stage and then let the narration weave through the actor's lines so that the sound effects and then the imagination of the audience can actually do all the heavy lifting. Hmm. So to end, I thought, let's listen to an example. Lucille Ball in the climax of the suspense episode titled A Little Piece of Rope. It's a good example of how some narration is mixed in with action. But I should also issue a warning. It's a grim, grim episode. So if you're faint of heart, be warned.
Throw the money. I can't reach it from here, you know. It's quite safe.
The wallet.
On that chest beside you by the lamp. Aren't you going to look to see that everything's there?
Why should I? I trust you. See you around.
Oh, he's gotten away. Alive. He must have guessed I'd done something to the lamp. But at least I had the money. I picked up the envelope and opened it. There was nothing in it but pieces of newspaper cut to the size of bills. Why, you dirty cheat! I ran to the door and opened it. I looked out, but he wasn't in sight. Before I could turn, I felt the rope around my neck. His hands were pulling it tight.
Oh, baby. I told you I'd see you around. Goodnight. You're paid off in full. Now, we'll just go back inside. Now, I'll take a look at that wallet, baby. I'll just turn on this light.
Wowzer, Katie. What a way to end it.
End it with a bang. I love that episode.
The do's and don'ts of writing for radio. End it with a bang. That should be one of the rules, right?
They did it on suspense a lot of times.
How you write for radio. Guidelines for radio writing circa 1940. I don't know if we could have those same rules today, but maybe so.
If radio drama comes back.
Yeah.
Boy, we may need to get out these old guidebooks again.
All right. Well, you know, you found them, so they must still be around.
Yeah.
I'm Steve Scherr. Katie Sewell, she's here giving us a little radio retrospective. See you again.
Thanks, Steve. So it is Thursday, and it's the day we check in with food writer Sarah Dickerman. And Sarah, you are in a Chinese food kind of mood.
I am. Well, there is this one Sichuan chef who has traveled from one restaurant to another, and everyone, all the Chinese food lovers around always keep an eye on him. And his most recent restaurant is called Spicy Talk.
He's in Redmond now? He was in Bellevue.
He was in Bellevue, and now he's in Redmond.
I should say his name is Cheng Biao Yang, and this is, when you say Spicy Talk, I'm assuming Sichuan food?
Yes? It is, which is, so Sichuan food is known for chili heat, but a very flavorful kind of chili heat, not sort of a numbing. It's almost got a fragrant quality. And another spice that is used in the same cuisine is Sichuan peppercorn, which is not actually a pepper, but it looks a little like one. And it actually has a slightly numbing quality on the tongue.
So, is that good or bad?
It's good. It's actually very fragrant. It's actually, I don't know how to explain it. It's just more of a roller coaster ride in your mouth. You have this really electrifying quality when it's used. And it's not used to excess. It doesn't you know, it doesn't make you feel uncomfortable, but it is just a little more stimulating even than a lot of other Chinese cuisines.
So spicy tteok is new in Redmond?
It's not brand new. No, it's been around for a little while, and it's really quite charming. It's in a strip mall, but you walk in, and it's sort of dark painted walls, and there's little handprints and footprints all over the wall in pretty earth colors, and there's dangling mobiles, and it's just really quite good. One thing they do are the don don noodles, which many listeners may be familiar with, which has this sort of peanutty tasting sesame broth or sauce. But they, at this place, they actually do the hand shaved noodles, so it's, you've got this sort of ruffled effect, quite chewy noodles. Just a wonderful texture with that delicious, slightly spicy, rich sesame sauce.
If you want to cook this yourself, you are recommending a writer who I've read as well, Fuchsia Dunlop, who is a traveler and a chef and a cookbook writer and a sort of travel writer as well.
Yes, I admire her terribly because she's a woman who traveled to Chengdu in Sichuan and actually took the professional cooking class in Chengdu at the professional cooking school. And then her first book is called Land of Plenty, Authentic Sichuan Recipes, personally gathered from the Chinese province of Sichuan. So she really knows her stuff. And she's interested in both the all different kinds of traditions, the restaurant traditions, which are more formal, complicated dishes, and then, of course, the home-style traditions, that, which are really the things that Americans may know best about Sichuan food, you know, mapo tofu, the tofu with spice and pork tossed together, or you know, ants on a tree. It's bean thread noodles with ground pork, and it's all sort of, they're all kind of crumbled up, and so it has a sort of, you know, sort of looks like little ants, but it's just crumbles of food.
And are these things hard to make?
You know, they do involve a trip to the specialty food store, but they're not actually that complicated once you have a few ingredients. You'll need your chili oil, and you'll need your maybe some Chinese vinegar. But, you know, she's so explicit in her instructions that you really feel like someone's holding your hand as you try things.
Okay, the author's name is Fuchsia, like the flower, Dunlop, D-U-N-L-O-P. She's got a couple of books. But if you're really not wanting to delve into that sort of cooking, you can just hie over to Redmond's Spicy Tteok and taste Chef Cheng Biaoyang's food.
Yes.
Which is much easier and probably a quicker, satisfactory hit, although your house won't smell like pepper.
I think both things are in order.
Well, Sarah, thanks for the recommendations. Sarah Dickerman writes about food for Slate, The New York Times, Bon Appetit, other publications. You can find her on Twitter at Sarah Dickerman or at sarahdickerman.com, and here on Thursdays on Weekday. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That makes me so hungry. I think that we all need to go eat don don noodles at Spicy Tteok in Redmond. Weekdays produced by Katie Sewell, Amina Alsadi, Jason Pagano, and Andy Hurst. Bernard Ouellette is engineering. I'm Marcy Silman, and you're going to want to join us tomorrow. Stone Gossard is going to be our guest. He's got his second solo album, and he'll talk about Pearl Jam too, Bernard.
We'll look forward to it. That's tomorrow on Weekday, which airs from 9 to 11 a.m. It's 10:59. A ricin-poisoned letter sent to President Obama. In the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle section of the American Society of Civil Engineers, celebrating 100 years of service in the Pacific Northwest. The 2013 report card for Washington State's infrastructure has now been released. More information is online at seattleasce.org.
Michael Caine is in a new movie, Now You See Me, and he's booked to act in several others. This year, Caine turned 80.
Occasionally a journalist will say, why don't you retire? And I say, you don't retire from the movies. The movies retire you.
Michael Caine on acting, aging, and accents today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.